Really? Okay, cool. Wow, that was shocking. Well, hey, everybody, welcome to the Big Boot Door Jam. Yay! Cool. I'm Joel Jones, and my wife is Jen, and on behalf of Big Boot Door, and on behalf of The Bridge, and on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which is the sponsor of this wonderful festival, we welcome you not only to the Big Boot Door Jam, but to the Virginia Festival of the Book. Yay! And since this is Thursday, you've already heard that a lot of times, I bet. For those of you who have been going to the Virginia Festival of the Book. We want to tell you a little bit about what's going on here, but I'm supposed to read several notes to you as part of the festival. So hold a second. Please turn off cell phones. And off was in, but actually if you have a babysitter and put them on vibrate, that's fine with us, we're not, ours are on vibrate. We want to thank The Bridge and Big Blue Door, that's us, yay. That's funny. Also, the festival is free of charge, but not free of cost. So if you want to go online to the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, you can find ways to contribute to them, because they're a great organization that does great things all year long in addition to this. Also, if you want to go online and check out thebridgepai.org, that's a great organization that's also volunteer-based and does a lot of great stuff. And we're so happy to be here. And bigbluedoor.org is us, and we've come here about 3 times this year, and it's always great to be back at The Bridge, so that's fantastic. Also, in addition to this being the Festival of the Book, you all got lots of paperwork, which is unusual for our monthly show. You've got those little there's an evaluation sheet we're going to give you, or you already got them, right? So if you could fill those out and leave them at the end, the Virginia Foundation of the Humanities uses those through the wonders of I don't know what, mathematics. They figure out all kinds of ways to make this festival what it is next year. Also, we gave you these little teeny cards to fill out with about books, and we've gotten some of them back. And if you haven't given them to us, you can give it to us during the break if you want, or you can hand it to right now. Oh, thank you. Those were the two we were waiting for the whole time. So there. And we're going to read some of these during the course of the show. What the show is it's we have 8 different storytellers who have signed up to tell 6 to 8 minute true stories. We ask that the stories be true, and we ask that they tell the stories without notes and without reading anything. There's also 3 volunteer teams of judges, and those judges will circle at the end the 3 favorite stories, and the storyteller who wins the most of those votes receives the Big Blue Door Jam. And that entitles them to return. We have once or twice a year, we have a best of, which is called a Big Blue Door Slam, and that's where the jam winners come back and they can tell another story and win an equally useless thing as this. But it's not really about competition, it's really about sharing, and we wanted a way for to involve lots of people, so the audience, it's great to have audience volunteers, it's great to have people telling stories. So please put your hands together for our wonderful storytellers tonight. Yay! Now, one other thing, they do have an 8-minute time limit, but we don't like yank them off stage. Instead, what we have is a little rattle. Who's got the rattle? Okay, at 6 minutes, you'll hear a little rattle, and at 7 minutes, you'll hear a rattle, and 8 minutes, and every minute after that, so they'll know, the person telling the stories will know that their time is running out, and much like all of us in this mortal coil. Well, that's true, but not, yes.
So I rattle at 6 minutes, too?
What did she tell you? What did Jen tell you?
I didn't tell her.
Oh. Well, that was different.
Oh,
so 7 minutes, 7 minutes. 7 and 8, okay. 7 and 8, and every 8 minute after that. So the thing is, when Tom Clay does this, gave away his name, but when he does this, everyone, it's better if you don't all turn around and look at it, because that'll freak out whoever's telling a story. So it's better to try to pretend like it's like a burp or something, just and try to go on listening. So without further ado, do we have any other notes before we start? No. Yeah, so ready for the can. I'm going to pull it. What we'll do is we'll pull out a name so the order is random. And just a second. I think just the little walk from there to here is just such a professional, no. So that's just this, the tension it builds, dramatic tension. Okay. First story teller of the night. This person is a research assistant at UVA. He's got a comedy podcast. It's funny. It's called Flee the Scene Pod. .com, so you can check that out. Put your hands together. He's a veteran of our show. Casey Suska.
Great. So both of my parents come from large Catholic families, and they went to Catholic school until they were teenagers, and they hated every minute of it. So I grew up in a house really without any religion. I mean, we celebrated Christmas and Easter as secular holidays, but the most that I learned about the Bible, arguably the most influential book in all of Western civilization, I learned from Jesus Christ Superstar. And I don't think I set foot in a church except for one time when I was five for a wedding. So it really surprised my friends when, in my senior year of high school, I started dating the daughter of the pastor for the big Presbyterian church in our neighborhood. She wasn't the rebellious sort of preacher's daughter. I think the worst trouble we got in was getting caught making out in a ball field after dark. And she also wasn't preachy or in your face with her faith, but I knew that it meant a lot to her. My lack of religion wasn't really a problem until we were graduating and getting ready to go off to different colleges. I was going to Penn State, and she was going to Vanderbilt University in Nashville. And that summer, she asked me to go to church with her for the first time. And I went, but I didn't like it, and frankly, I didn't get it. And I told her this, but I also promised I would make a genuine effort to explore Christianity. In college, the friends that I made in my dorm were a mix of lax Catholics and staunch atheists. One Saturday evening in the first month of my freshman year of college, a Catholic, an atheist, and myself are sitting in a courtyard outside of our dorm, and we are engaged in a classic college trope that's spending a perfectly good Saturday evening having an hours-long philosophical conversation. At one point, while my atheist friend is ranting about Christianity, an upperclassman comes by, and he overhears our conversation, and he says that we have some misconceptions about God and the Bible, and joins in and proceeds to try to dissuade us of those misconceptions and take up his view. And he and my atheist friend argue, and I listen, and I realize that this upperclassman has some good things to say. After the conversation breaks down, everyone heads back inside, and I take this upperclassman aside, and I explain that I'm not very religious, but my girlfriend is, so I'm making an effort to learn more about the Bible. So what a coincidence that someone like him just comes along. He asks if I want to join a Bible study that he leads with, he has some other guys in the dorm, and I agree, and he offers to meet with me beforehand a couple times to get me prepared. Then he asks if I have a Bible. What a coincidence, I say. I actually just had to buy one as a textbook for my Western civilization class. And he says, it's not a coincidence. It's a sign from God. And I am so moved. I am smiling so big, and we embrace. And we make plans to meet up at 8 p.m. on Tuesday by the big TV in the student union. That Tuesday morning, I head to my Western Civilization class at 8 a.m. After 20 minutes, the professor finally arrives, and he looks concerned. And he says that we probably missed the news because we got to class before it happened, but a plane just crashed into the World Trade Center. He cancels class, and I head back to my dorm. So I'm there with my friends, watching as the second plane hits and the towers fall. We follow the news at the Pentagon. We're just glued to the TV all day. By the time evening rolls around, everyone is sort of numb, and there's really nothing else that we can watch. And I'm supposed to meet my Bible tutor at 8 p.m. I know there's a really good chance he won't show, but I don't have his phone number. I don't know where he lives in our big 300-person dorm. I don't even know his last name. All I know is that his first name might be Andrew, this might be my only chance to meet with him. I head to the student union anyway. I stand by the big TV, holding my Bible, and I watch images of firefighters pulling bodies out of the rubble. I watch replays of the second plane hitting and the towers falling. Finally, at 9 p.m., I leave. On my way back to my dorm room, I just keep thinking, what bullshit? I'm not disappointed in Andrew, my would-be Bible tutor. I'm disappointed in myself. Disappointed for mistaking some trivial coincidence as something bigger than it was. Disappointed that if there is a God, he picked a really horrific way to test my commitment to learning more about him. And I realize none of this is for me. I get back to my dorm to find all of my friends crowded around our tiny TV, and they have been wondering where I am, because I am missing something that will go down in legend for this friend group. While randomly flipping through the channels, they stumbled across a raw satellite feed of NBC reporter Jim Mikliszewski at the Pentagon. What a coincidence to even find this channel, they say. And as soon as we turned it on, he just happened to give out his cell phone number off the air. And they have been prank calling him, and he has been calling them idiots, and why don't you have any dates, and you got no class, that's your problem, right to the camera. They call him back, and he is so mad. He is swearing at his producer. He can barely keep it together when he is on the air. And this helps me regain my grounding. And I realize all of these coincidences are what we make of them. And I can't change what I believe through happenstance. I never did discover God. I never saw Andrew, my would-be Bible tutor, again. At the end of that semester, I sold that Bible, along with all the rest of my textbooks, back to the bookstore. And that summer, the preacher's daughter and I broke up because the distance was too hard. For many people, 9/11 changed their lives in severe and profound ways. And for me, it just brought things back to the way they always were. Thank you.
Casey Suska. Next up is an actor and playwright. She wrote and performs Dirty Barbie and Other Girlhood Tales. It's a great show if you haven't seen it. Next, it's going to be performed on 25th of April at Newcomb Hall to benefit the Women's Center. And put your hands together for Dee Dee Stewart. Yeah.
When I was 8 years old, there was a book that I read and reread and reread, and it was called To Elvis with Love. It was about this little girl. She was also 8 years old, and she lived in Stockholm in a state institution, and she had cerebral palsy, and her parents had abandoned her. She was very bitter. She was really shut down. She didn't want to have anyone in her life, but she had one soft spot for Elvis. She loved Elvis Presley, and she wrote him letter after letter after letter. And eventually, true story, he wrote her back. And I loved this book, and I read this book, and I loved Karen, and I came to love Elvis through loving Karen. And I wanted to be closer to this man. I had a huge crush on Elvis. When I was 22, I graduated from college, and I was living in North Carolina, and I decided I was going to drive across country, move to Seattle, and live with my sister. And so then my roommate, who had nothing to do and nowhere to go, asked if she could go too. And I said, sure. So I began to make plans. First plan was to decide where I was going to go. How was I going to get across country? First stop was going to be Graceland. I was going to Graceland. Graceland, Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee, I was going to Graceland. second plan, second step, is I began to plan a kidnapping. With Stacy as my accomplice, on the night before we left, we snuck into the rooms of my other roommates and we took their prized stuffed animals off of their beds. I have never understood stuffed animals, and I did not approve of grown women having stuffed animals on their beds. So in an act of spirit and in an act of final last words, I took a pig and a bear and Tigger. And I took them, and I took duct tape, and I wrapped duct tape across their mouths, and I bound their furry little paws, and I lined them across the back seat because I had bought a camcorder at the pawn shop, and I was going to film a wacky documentary of my trip across country with my hostages, these animals. And then I wrote out a sheet of paper that said Seattle or bust, and I put it in the back window. On the second day of our trip, we were in Graceland having a tour. I had the earphones on. I was listening to the meditative voice of Priscilla Presley as she walked us through each room and told us the details of Elvis's life and death and his family, and I was enjoying myself. And at lunch, we were having cheeseburgers and French fries. And I don't know what got into me. I do not know what got into me, but I started to shit talk Elvis. I was being very critical. I was just dogging everything, dogging his clothes and dogging his house, dogging his choices. According to me, Elvis could do nothing right. When we were leaving Graceland and getting out of Memphis, trying to get back on the interstate, I turned, trying to turn left at this large intersection, and I should have yielded. I was turning left, and this old man in an old white beat-up truck plowed into my white Honda Accord. And we were shaking. We were okay, but I was so scared, and I was so sure I knew why this had happened. So we were parked over here, and he was parked over there. We were sitting there, and before very long at all, two policemen showed up. And the first policeman's writing up the report, walking around my car, and I'm following him, right behind him, explaining myself, telling him why this had happened. And didn't he think it was weird as we walked across this big intersection towards the other truck? Didn't he think it was weird? Didn't he think it was spooky that this old man wasn't even getting out of his truck? Wasn't even looking at us. And the policeman turned around and said, hey, he doesn't have to get out of his truck. This is a busy intersection. And he didn't do anything wrong. And then he hands me a ticket. Meanwhile, the other policeman, who had also been inspecting my car, comes up to me. Is it? Pulls his sunglasses down. He says, well, you girls may be all right, but I believe Tigger's got whiplash. So these stuffed animals had softened the policeman. And he was intrigued and decided he was going to help us. And he said that the Honda was drivable. It was drivable, but not for very long. And the only place that we could take this Honda was to Jerry, because Jerry loved Hondas. And so he gave me very convoluted instructions, and we're driving. And it was almost as if Jerry must have been forewarned, because when we showed up at Jerry's auto body shop, all of Jerry's staff and Jerry were standing out on the loading dock waiting. And I pull up in the Honda, and Jerry's got white beard and comes down, and he won't even speak to me. He's walking around the car. This is when I know Jerry was not originally from Memphis. He's walking around, groaning, sighing, oh boy. This was a beautiful Honda. this was a beautiful Honda, and the back is just violent, you know, it's violent, and the trunk lid has been like lifted up like a piece of foil, and you can see right into it like a peanut butter jar. And he's saying, you know, oh boy, oh, and he looks at me and he says, look what you did to this Honda. And I said, I know, but can you fix it? And he's like, well, you don't know. What you don't know is that a Honda has got a unibody construction. I can't just pull off the back quarter panel and just stick on a new one. This is a unibody construction. I got to order this. It's going to take 2 weeks. What you got to do is you got to call your mom and dad, and you're going to have to get a rental car, drive back to North Carolina, drive back, stay with your mom and dad. I'll order the parts, fix the car. You come back in about 3 weeks, off you go. Well, what Jerry didn't know is that my parents were dead. And my father had died when I was 5. My mother had died just 9 months before. And what Jerry didn't know was that even though his plan seemed reasonable, it was absolutely the last thing I was going to do. And what Jerry didn't know is I had just graduated with an acting degree, and that in that moment, I knew exactly what I had to do. I said, my parents are dead. And I am just on my own. And the whole reason that we are doing this is that so I can go to Seattle and be with my sister. And Jerry's face was like this. And he said, Bobby, you know what we're going to do? We're going to drill 2 holes in the side of this. We're going to pull this out. We're going to pound it out. We're going to put, you know, that, we're going to get that tan trunk lid. You got that tan trunk lid? We're going to put the tan trunk lid on, and we're going to put duct tape all over it, and we're going to get you out of the door. Tomorrow morning, we're going to do it right now. And I said, okay. And as we were leaving, he said, you're going, pss, pss, pss. You know, Bobby, you know what happened to Bobby? Bobby's wife left him. Just out of the blue. Bobby's wife left him, and he's got 4 kids. It's salt of the earth, this guy. Salt of the earth. So he's going to take you guys to the hotel, and maybe you guys could go line dancing tonight or something. So the next morning, we didn't go line dancing with Bobby. He was too shy to ask. But the next morning, he came back, and Jerry had done just what he had said. He had drilled 2 holes in the side of that Honda, pulled it out, pounded it out, looked like somebody's burned foot, stuck a tan trunk lid on it, put duct tape on it, and it was Seattle or bust, baby. And the 3 things I learned from that story was, 1, occasionally, stuffed animals can be useful. 2, it's okay sometimes to cry and play the dead parents card. And 3, always, always think of Elvis with love. Thank you.
Dee Dee Stewart, everybody.
You.
Read a couple of these things that you guys put in. Let's see. Favorite book? Another Country by James Baldwin. What's the earliest book that sticks in your mind? The Berenstain Bears. If your life inspired a book, what would the book be called? Master of Life Balance. Whether it be fiction or nonfiction, fiction. Master of Life Balance. And then there would be the sequel movie, Master of Life Balance 2. What is your favorite book? American Pastoral. What is the earliest book that sticks in your mind? The K. And the other two are not answered. What is your favorite book? Poisonwood Bible. What is the earliest book that sticks in your mind? Anne of Green Gables. If your life inspired a book, what would the book be called? The Road Most Traveled. And it would be nonfiction. Yeah. Okay. What is your favorite book? A Thousand Splendid Suns. What is the earliest book that sticks in your mind? Go, Dog, Go. Everyone remember that? In fact, that line never actually appears in Go, Dog, Go, because in the book, it's always Go, Dogs, Go at the beginning. So just because I have a little daughter, I know that. The classic off rhyme at the end, where they go to the party in the tree or something? No, a dog party at the end. If you don't have children, you don't know what I'm talking about. If you were a life-inspired book, what would the book be called? Do You Like My Hat? Awesome. Would it be fiction or nonfiction? It would be fiction, a picture book. Wow. We're going to do this. I'm going to do one more. Okay. What is your favorite book? Angle of Repose. What is the earliest book that sticks in your mind? Green Eggs and Ham. What if your life inspired a book, what would the book be called? Keep the Ghost Going. Yeah, not bad. Would it be fiction or nonfiction? Dramatized Life Story. So I guess that would be an E. This is, you know, they're here for the Festival of TV next year. So we'll read a couple more of those later. Did I put that back in the box? Oh, I did. So we may be reading that again later. once I accidentally, you don't need to hear this. Let's go on. now this person, next person has done just about everything. And she's currently like a property manager, but later this spring, she is going to spend April camping in the desert for the first time ever, because she's always wanted to do that. Put your hands together for Joan Schatzman.
Hi, everybody. Hi. In October of 1978, I drove up to Washington, D.C. with my two friends, Debbie Hanley and Debbie Welsh, to meet Jonas, the owner of a 31-foot sailboat. He wanted to sell his boat and thought that Florida would be a good place to do that. He needed a crew, and he asked around, and eventually he heard about us. We were eager for adventure, although we had very little experience. I once went sailing in my cousin's boat on Lake Kentucky. He offered us 2 weeks of food for the voyage and return transportation to Virginia. We accepted. He really hired us to have sex. Think again, Jonas, we're lesbians. We stowed our gear, battened down the hatches, and cast off, sailing down the Potomac. Debbie Hanley and I pulled the first night watch because Jonas could only navigate by sight. He had charts, but he didn't know how to read them. Fortunately, Debbie Hanley packed along her copy of Chapman's Piloting, a guide to sailing and navigation. We pored over this book for the rest of as much as we possibly could. We entered the ditch at the Great Dismal Swamp. With our newly acquired nautical knowledge, we were able to sail down Pamlico Sound and Albemarle Sound and down to Morehead City, where we left the ditch to go out into the blue water. I wish that I had tasted the water we took on at Morehead City, because it tasted like hose water. It was undrinkable and unsuitable for cooking. Jonas had no weather radio. He picked up a copy of the Morehead News for the 10-day forecast. Tropical storm Kendra was forming in the Caribbean. It was headed due north toward Florida, our destination. But for now, the waters were smooth, the sailing was smooth as we headed toward Cape Fear. That night, Debbie Hanley and I were sailing, and I saw the luminous phosphorescence coming off the bow. It was beautiful. I scooped my hand in the water and held up my arm, and it sparkled. The water started getting choppy off of South Carolina. Kendra had been upgraded to gale force winds. That night, Debbie Hanley and I tied ourselves to the boat so we wouldn't get washed overboard. Rogue waves would slap over the bow and flood into the galley, knocking ramen noodles into the bilge, bursting open into long, snaky, wormy strands. Everything got wet. the matches to light the stove, DW's cigarettes, and the charts. The main sail started to get frayed. We were sailing with only a jib. 12-foot waves pounded the rudder, eventually breaking the steering cable. Debbie Hanley patched it together with cable clamps. Kendra had been upgraded to a Class 1 Hurricane. We were drinking cold, hose-watered flavor coffee, eating cold noodles. We were exhausted from 24/7 sailing. We demanded that Jonas turn toward land so we could find a place to repair the boat. He reluctantly agreed, saying that he was on a schedule and he had to get to Florida. The next morning, we tried to make a landing at St. Mary's off the Georgia coast. I was at the helm. We sailed toward the beach. The closer we got, the bigger the breakers. Suddenly, a following wave lifted the boat and pushed it toward an oncoming broadside, a huge broadside. I looked up. I saw hundreds of thousands of green water towering overhead, about to crash down and crush us. I was seized with fear. And in that same moment, Chapman's piloting guide came back to me. It was counterintuitive. It said, turn into the wave, turn into the wave. So I pushed the tiller hard to lee toward the broadside. We slid down off the wave into the trough. I pulled the tiller again to the starboard, and we tacked out to sea where it was a little safer. After our scuttled attempt to land, after the landing was scuttled, we begged Jonas to press the emergency rescue button. He refused. He said the Coast Guard charges money for rescues. The waves continued to swamp us, and Jonas continued to refuse. As night was approaching and the weather was getting worse, we had had enough. There was only one thing left to do: mutiny. Debbie, give me your knife. Jonas, if you don't push that button, I am going to murder you. Okay. He pushed the button. We kept sailing south toward Ponce Inlet, waiting for the Coast Guard to come and rescue us. The closer we got, we finally became in sight of Ponce Inlet, and we saw some flat water, and we decided to head toward it. As we approached, we saw waves breaking over rocks. It was a breakwater. It was too late to turn around. Suddenly, a big wave picked us up and threw us at the rocks. High tide and a storm surge lifted us over the rocks and plunked us down in the middle of the flat, calm water of the inlet, just as the Coast Guard came cruising up. Who knows how to tie a bowline? A sailor shouted. Jonas said, don't take the line. They'll claim the boat for salvage. I said, Jonas, they don't want your boat. They want to save us. I took the line and tied it to the cleat. The Coast Guard towed us to the dock. They retained Jonas for questioning and let us go. We were starving. We ran to the highway. We hitchhiked north to Daytona and straight to the McDonald's for a Big Mac and fries. The next day, we went back to the boatyard where we got our transportation money from Jonas's unattended wallet and went and called Elaine to come rescue us. And that is the first time I was rescued by the Coast Guard.
Joan Shossman, everybody. I just gave her the first time. If you ever come, we do this third Thursday of every month. And if you're interested, you can go online, bigbluedoor.org, and see our upcoming themes. And if you have a story, we'd love to have you tell one. And the first time you tell a story at a Big Blue Door Jam, you get this this little keychain with a little door, and that you'll treasure for the rest of your life, more than anything else you've ever owned. No, you won't. But it's a nice little thing. I'm going to read one more of these, and then we'll have one more story before we take a little break. That's people's names. This is the one I just read. Oh, yeah. Favorite book? Ulysses. What is the earliest book that sticks in your mind? James and the Giant Peach. If your life inspired a book, what would it be called? Not a bad title, actually. Would it be fiction or nonfiction? Both and neither. What is your favorite book? Oh, we just read that one earlier. What is your favorite book? Currently, Telegraph Avenue. What is the earliest book that sticks in your mind? Tip and Mitten, first book I ever read. What if your life inspired a book, what would the book be called? Who, me? And would it be fiction or nonfiction? It would be fiction. Cool. And our next storyteller before the break, last one before the break, is this person is a resident of Douglas Avenue here, Belmont local person, live arts veteran. He's performing in the upcoming August Osage County at Live Arts, so you want to check that out. Leo Errico.
Hi, good to see everybody. I have a book. I actually have this book at home. It's right around the corner on Douglas Avenue. It's my dinosaur book I got when I was 6 years old, and I actually have this book, but I can't put my hand on it. My mother used to do that, and I thought it was funny. I don't think it's so funny anymore. But I got this when I was very sick. I had a lot of childhood diseases of the throat and ears. I had my tonsils out as I was coming down with strep throat. And so I was recovering from tonsillectomy with a strep throat, which nearly killed me, I found out years later. But I didn't know that at the time. I just knew I was in a lot of pain, and it took a very, very long time. So this dinosaur book, I was about six, and this book was way ahead of a six-year-old. It had lots of color plates in it. And, you know, it started out as little snowmen, snowflakes, and the pinwheels, and the little corkscrew. And then they got to be the animals, the creatures looked like little machines, little things that crawled around, looked almost like something other than a living creature. And then they came out of the water, and they were huge and ugly. They didn't look like anything you'd ever see. They had stuff growing out of their back. They had too many tails and too many horns, and they would eat each other. They would actually tear each other apart right there in the book, and it was red and bloody and everything else. This was just amazing for a six-year-old. And then later on, there were the little fish creatures and the bird creatures and the lizards like you'd see in your carport and that sort of thing. Well, this book was, it lived in the house that I lived in from 1957. My mother died in 1995, and the book was still there. And first it was, do you want this? You know, can I have that? And then eventually it was, you know, scorched earth, slash and burn, get it out the front door, empty the house, just get it all out of here. When the second parent goes, that's when the work really begins. So the book made it to Charlottesville, and it's here, but it's just not here. I wish I had it tonight. When I was 6 years old, we lived in Fairfax County, and we had central air conditioning. So my grandmother from Brooklyn would come down and stay for the summers. This is my Italian grandmother. That whole part of the family, they were all born 19th century. They spoke Italian, and they were all dead before we put a man on the moon. And so she spoke to my father, but she never really spoke to anybody else. I never saw her pick up a newspaper. I never saw her actually read anything. And one day she was sitting on the couch, and I was sitting on the couch, and so was my dinosaur book. And she picked it up, and she turned the pages, and the little creatures and little machines, and then there were the blood and the tearing apart and everything else. And then she got towards the back of the book, and she put her finger on the page. And said, family. One word, family. And that's really the only conversation that we ever had. Well, the chapter heading was Modern Families Appear, and that was the fish and the birds and the little lizards. Well, that stuck in my mind because she actually spoke to me in English. I didn't know that familia was Italian for family, so that was not a stretch for her. Well, the book made it here, and about a little over 2 years ago, I found it, and I took it to my son's wedding, and I used it as a prop when I gave the groom's father's speech and related the story of my grandmother, a little walnut with a pair of eyes, and the word family that she said to me. And even though all these things, these little machines and things that didn't look real to anybody, you know, especially to a child. What was real to her was family. And all these years, I have kept that in the back of my mind, and I realized that this was the most important thing that she could say to me that would eventually have great meaning all the way through the rest of my life. And that's my dinosaur book story. Thank you.
Leo Erica, everybody. So we're going to take a little five-minute break. 5 minutes, yeah. So if you need to go to the bathroom, or if you, we don't have anything to serve you, so you can, I don't know, lick the dust on the floor. I don't know what they, that place next door is actually closed now, so there's, but if you can smoke, take up smoking if you don't already smoke.